Bibles to the book of Revelation, the 12th chapter, Revelation chapter 12. Hopefully you'll see this in a minute. I think maybe I didn't have it plugged in. Good. Revelation chapter 12. I want to begin reading there in verse 1 in just a moment. Appreciate all of you being here. We have a little bit thinner crowd, probably because of the weather and other things, but good to have you here. Revelation chapter 1, there is a story, a picture that's pretty scary, I would say, to any mother, father, grandmother, grandfather. It says, there was a great sign in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of thorns, and she was with child, and cried out, being in labor and in pain to give birth. And another sign appeared in the heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having seven heads and 10 horns, and on his head were 7 diadems. And his tail swept across a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she gave birth, he might devour the child. And she gave birth to the son, a man-child, who would rule over the nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up to God, to his throne. In this text, you have a text about the coming of the church, about the kingdom, about God's family, and a birth being given born to Jesus Christ, who in time would be the ruler of the earth. You can see in verse 13, when the dragon saw that he was thrown down to the earth, he persecuted the woman. You think about that being the people of God, whether it was the Hebrew nation or the church, who gave birth to the male child. And you can see in verse 17, the dragon was enraged with the woman and went off to make war with her offspring who keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. In this text, you see a tragic picture. You see a beautiful woman about to give birth to a baby, and sitting right at her feet was the dragon. The dragon was so powerful that when his tail swung across the earth, it just wiped out many of the stars of the earth. In that text, what I would say to you is this. A couple of things I want you to think about. The devil actually only did his business personally 3 times in all of the Bible. That was true in the case of the Garden of Eden. It was true in the case of Job when he tested Job. And it was true in Matthew chapter 4 when Jesus was in the wilderness. But there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases where things and people were attributed to the devil, evil people, society, nations. Oftentimes, they were the devil's proxy. They were doing the devil's work for him. I would say to you, what you will learn from scriptures is, every single woman that has ever given birth to a child from Eve forward, they knew, they should have known at least, that the devil was sitting right at their feet waiting to devour their child when it was born. We had an announcement this morning about a young baby about to be born. We have another expecting mother here. From the beginning of time, the devil was there waiting for the baby to be born so that he might devour it. I want to give you some examples of that as we look at text this morning. This is a lesson I did a number of years ago, but we have quite a number more young mothers and young children here than we did at that time, so I wanted to spend some time on this. I want you to think with me about changes in the world that we live in today. In this audience today, we have people that are 80 years old. We have people that are 60 years old. We have people that are 40 years old. We have people that are 20 years old. And we have babies, little tiny babies. Do you think that the 80-year-old people in this congregation have seen a lot of changes in our society in their lifetime? I can remember when I was a little boy, this was probably 50 or 52 years ago, because I'm going to talk about this next, but my grandparents lived off a good ways, one in East Texas and one up in the Channelview Highlands area. So it was important to my mother and father that I spend 2 weeks with one grandparent and 2 weeks with the other grandparent every single summer. And then Christmas time, we would spend several days. They wanted me to have access to another generation of people, people who were from a different point in time. I can remember thinking about meeting my grandparents' family and friends. Everybody lived on a farm. Everybody lived on a farm. Now, somebody that was born on Brigance Road, not born here, but got here as quick as I could, on Brigance Road, and then moved when I was 7 years old to the city in West Columbia, Texas, I used to think that was the goofiest thing in the world. How is it that everybody was raised on a farm? This was a little bit like walking 3 miles upstream, you know, in East Texas, and it snowed every winter. Well, it didn't snow by the time I got there. And so what happened is I couldn't really believe, I couldn't understand the fact that most people who were 80 or 100 years old were raised on a farm, but they in fact were. You've seen basically after World War II this movement of factories being built because of the war and other things. You see this movement of people coming from the rural communities into the cities. When people lived on a farm many years ago, they had a very protected, very pristine world. When I stayed up in Huntington, Texas, where my grandmother and grandfather lived, Lufkin had a TV station, one, Channel 9. The TV station was on from 7 p.m. until 10 p.m., 5 days a week. Now imagine today what you have. So children were raised up in very pristine environment where the only people that you were exposed to was the people that your parents wanted you to be exposed to. And the only thing that you saw on television was what was very clean and things that anybody would approve of. So there has been a tremendous shift now, people moving into the cities, going to school with hundreds of people, and the exposure to all kinds of people and all kinds of things are pretty huge. The loss of extended family. When I was putting this together, I was thinking about, we have here in this congregation a good number of cases where the grandmother and grandfather and great-grandmother and great-grandfather all live pretty close in the same town. That's a huge thing. I'm going to tell you, we live in a world today that we're just like a gas station. You come in and gas up and take off this direction and this direction. Kids finish their schooling and they move over here 10 states away, and then the other one moves over here many states away. And you don't have that extended family that was common throughout all the Old Testament period of time, the New Testament period of time. And it was true in this day and our day and time up until probably 40 or 50 years ago. Now, those of you that were young would say, well, it's always been this way. It hadn't even been this way in my lifetime. So what you have happen is you now have people who basically have moved into a world where they're exposed to all kinds of things. They do not have multi-generations of people helping to impart wisdom to them. And it's made a huge difference. The second thing is, in World War II, there was a gigantic change. Now, this we're talking about 60 to 70 years ago, but women left the home and went into the workplace. And by and large, they never left. When you look today, the number of women, mothers in this country, about 82% of all mothers work. That's just how it is. And you can explain that away however you want to. I'm really not going to deal with all the reasons for it, but I am going to deal with how does it impact the red dragon sitting there waiting to devour your child. That's what I'm talking about. That's what I want to talk about this morning. What I would tell you is this. Women working in the workforce, when you begin looking at Titus chapter 2 where it says older women were to teach the younger women how to love their husbands, how to love their children, to be chaste, pure, keepers of the home. By and large, that's a lost art. It's not even something that we think is important anymore. But what did that get replaced with? It got replaced with daycare and preschool and the TV and the internet raising my kid and this person for a while and this person for a while and this person for a while and this person for a while. Sometimes that works out well and sometimes it does not work out well. But I would tell you, when there is no keeper of the home, there is no person that says my responsibility above all other responsibilities in the world is to keep the home, to be the keeper of the home. You think about, this is the time that I came into being adult, started thinking about being adult. I graduated high school in 1972 and lived right here in West Columbia, Texas, and I had Mr. Cates and Mr. Lively. Some of you might have known them. They were the biology and the English, the chemistry teacher in Columbia High School. And I thought, well, I knew a lot about the world. When I went to the University of Houston, just 50 miles away, and there were about 40,000 people at the University of Houston, I saw things that I did not thought existed in the world. And I can remember thinking when I was 20 or 22 years of age, I would have pictured this in San Francisco or Detroit or New York City, but not in Houston. I'm talking about drugs like you can't imagine, and people sleeping together, and what we called it shacking up back in those days. Now it's called hooking up, I understand. That's what the younger people tell me. But that's a tremendous difference. I want you to think about television shows for just a moment. I want you to think about when I was a child. Now, we're talking several generations ago. We had TV shows like Leave It to Beaver. Any of you remember that show? What about Father Knows Best? What about Andy of Mayberry or the Andy Griffin Show? What about, and you can go on and on and on and on. You could name dozens and dozens of them. What you saw in these pictures for our consumption was, here's a daddy, and the daddy was the strong person in the family. He was the leader in the family, and mama was a good mother, and the children were respectful, and they behaved themselves. And it was a picture of what American families looked like. The first show that I saw that was a deviation from that, to me at least, was the Bill Cosby Show. Now, there were a lot of things between there, where there were gay people living together. And there was a show for a while that Linda and I liked where the dad was kind of the old hippie and the young boy was played by Michael J. Fox, and he was the straight-up guy that wore the suit. The Bill Cosby Show was the first show I saw where the dumbest person in the family was the daddy. And from that came show after show after show after show for 20 to 30 years, from Home Improvement to you name it. And it was portrayed. And so a generation of people grew up believing that the 2-year-old or the 4-year-old in the family was smarter than daddy. Mama was probably the smartest person in the family. This is because of people like Norman Lear and others, where every single script had to be pushed through the American Society of whatever it is, and the National Association of Women. But fundamentally, basically, men were taken out of the picture. They're so stupid and they're so dumb, they can't do anything, which was in direct contradiction to what the Lord said the job of a husband was to be. We have now seen a world where fundamentally, I matter. I'm the only thing that matters. What's good for me? How does this make me feel? How does it make me look? What do I think about this? And everything in the world is tied to me, 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 me. I would say to you, there have been many things, and you probably could name a dozen more, that have fundamentally blown up the American family. Just look around you. And I'll tell you this. We talk about, oh, we had $10 trillion in debt, and now 8 years later we got $20 trillion in debt, and we're going to have $30 trillion in debt. And before long, we will, if interest rates were to rise to 5 or 6%, which is the norm, we will spend 60 to 70% of our entire American budget on interest on the note. What caused that? Families blowing up. Families blowing up. We can't print enough money to fix all the problems that have come from families blowing up and completely disintegrating. What I would tell you is this attitude of I want it all and I want it now, and I may not want to work for it, but I want it now and I deserve it. I deserve it. And I would tell you we have seen tremendous changes in that. I want you to turn with me to Genesis, the 6th chapter. When you think about the story that I read to you from Revelation chapter 12, where the woman gives birth to the baby and the dragon, this massive dragon, is sitting there waiting for the baby to be born to devour it. What you see in Genesis chapter 6, a little bit about the world that Noah lived in. chapter 6 and verse 5. The Lord saw that wickedness was great on the earth and that every intent and thought of the heart was only evil continually. I would tell you a couple things about that verse of Scripture. Number one, I am absolutely confident that the world that we're living in today, I don't care how bad it is, and I don't care how bad you think it is, it's not this bad. Number one, I know a few godly people around, so there's no chance that every thought and every intention of every person's brain was only evil continually. Secondly, I know he's not destroying us yet. This is a line of demarcation. You see it with Sodom and Gomorrah. You see it in the book of Isaiah. We're going to be studying in time where a nation goes down and somewhere along the line, God said, there is not enough salt and light. When that happens, he destroys the world or the city and he saves the handful of people surgically that were redeemable. Now in looking at this, I want you to look in verse 9. These are the records of generation of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his time. So when God looked upon the earth, there was only one man that was worth saving in the entire world. And I don't know how many millions of people there were. The world had been around for at least 4,000 or 5,000 years, somewhere in that range, by the time of the flood, about 2,450 years before Christ. Now in looking at this, in verse 18, I will establish a covenant with you and you when you enter the ark, you and your sons and your wives and your sons' wives with you. That was how these people were saved. It's the 7th chapter in verse 1. You see, the Lord God said, enter the ark, you and your household, for you alone have I seen to be righteous before me in this time. That's how bad it was. There were eight people total. Noah and his wife and his three sons and their wives. When God looked over the earth, he said, there's nothing else salvageable. I'm going to kill all the animals. I'm going to kill all the plants. And I'm going to kill everything. This morning we were talking about in our class, if you were a person who didn't understand God at all and you had never read your Bible, and you look at something like that, you would think, that's horrible. That's terrible. That would make a lot of kids in college nowadays have to go to a safe room someplace and get a teddy bear. But we understand that that's how God conducts his business. I would tell you, when you take a look at the 8th chapter in verse 18, so Noah went out from the ark, he and his sons, his wives and sons with them. In chapter 9 and verse 1, God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. How in the world did a man fight the entire world for his children? Noah and his wife had to fight everybody. They had to fight every single human being. Now you think about when Noah's wife gave birth to their sons, that same devil was sitting there waiting to devour their children too, like he devoured every other child on earth. How did they make it? He was blameless in his generation. He was above reproach, God said. When he looked, not only I'm confident that if Noah had one or two wicked sons, they wouldn't have made it on the ark. Those boys had to be righteous too. They spent 120 years building a boat that was going to save them. But I would say to you, that was God's plan from the very beginning. In the book of Exodus, the first chapter, Exodus chapter 1, we have a man and a woman named Amram and Jochebed. You can see in Numbers chapter 26 that they had three children. They had a baby girl named Miriam. And then 9 years later, they had a boy named Aaron. And then 3 years after that, they had a little baby boy named Moses. These are the parents of Moses and Aaron and Miriam. In Exodus chapter 1 and verse 15, if you take a look at Exodus chapter 1 and verse 7, 6 and 7, you can see that verse 7, sons of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly and multiplied and became exceedingly mighty in the land that filled them. And a king arose over Egypt that did not know Joseph. And he said to the people, behold, the sons of Israel are more and mightier than us. That's what caused him to make the decision We're going to kill every baby. We're going to kill every baby boy, and to make sure that they don't continue to make babies and keep growing faster than we're growing. In the first chapter in verse 15, the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom one of whom was named Shiphrah, the other was named Puah, and he said to them, when you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth, see them on the birth stool. They're ready to give birth, and the midwives have now been called in. If it is a son, then you shall put him to death, but if it is a daughter, she shall live. They use the young ladies for other purposes. And in verse 17, but the midwives feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and let the boys live? And the midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They are rigorous and they give birth to before the midwives can get there. That was their story. And God was good to the midwives, and the people multiplied and became mighty. And it came about because the midwives feared God that he established them households. And Pharaoh, the commander of all the people, said, every son who is born you shall cast into the Nile River, and every daughter you shall keep alive. How is it that these midwives that didn't really have any personal stake, they were just a baby deliverer. They just knew when a mother was about to give birth, they needed to get over there. They would deliver the child, make sure everything was done. But it wasn't their child. This was just their job. What was it that God placed in the hearts of these midwives to make them say, I don't care what the king says. I don't care what he says. I am going to do what is right by God. Eventually now, you can see in the second chapter, there was a man named from the house of Levi, verse 2, and a woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could not hide him any longer, she got a basket, covered it with tar and pitch, and put the child in it, and set it amongst the reeds of the bank of the Nile. And his sister stood at a distance to find what would happen to him. And you know that story very well. I'm not going to go into detail, but to make this point, what was it that made these midwives separate from Amram and Jochebed? Amram and Jochebed had a stake in the game. This was their child. This was their baby child. And the devil was sitting there about ready to devour it, because it was supposed to be, I just read to you, that every baby was born was going to be thrown in the Nile River. I can understand a little bit the faith of Amram and Jochebed. What has always challenged me is the midwives. The only thing that they had to hold on to was their fear of God. And they feared God more than they feared the government. How many times today do the government tell us to do things that we are not right? Or our bosses or whoever tell us to do, this is what I need you to do. Much like what Peter and John said in the book of Acts, the 4th chapter, we must obey God rather than man. That's what they said. And because of that, they beat the devil. Hannah, you remember, the mother of Samuel. She did not have the ability to have a child. The other wife of Elkanah had babies. And so she would taunt Hannah. And Hannah prayed and prayed and prayed. And she eventually one time was praying to the point that the high priest looked at her and thought she was drunk. It was in the morning. He goes over there to her and says, what are you drinking? Are you becoming a crazy woman? She said, I'm not drunk. I am so concerned about, I want to have a baby. She was willing to give that child when he was 2 years old to the Lord. You remember right after that is when Samuel had this voice that came to him in the night as a little boy saying, God talking to him, and Eli didn't know what was going on. About the third time, Eli said, go lay down, Samuel. I think the Lord's trying to talk to you. And the Lord told this little boy some incredible things that were going to happen to Eli and his household. Now, a woman prays all of her life. She's now beyond childbearing years, more than likely. She finally gets a baby, and she's so thankful she gives it back to the Lord. And once a year, she gets to see this child. But Samuel grew up to be a very godly man, a wonderful man. Acts chapter 16, the Apostle Paul had heard about this young man named Timothy. And Timothy was a wonderful man, that he was of high report to all the brethren around there. So he made a trip to see this young man, Timothy. And when he saw Timothy, he met his mother and his grandmother, Eunice and Lois. Now, he had a daddy. This is what we know about his daddy. Acts 16, 1 and 2. His daddy was a Greek. I have to tell you that his daddy apparently had nothing to do with who Timothy was and who Timothy was going to be. When you look at 2 Timothy chapter 1, and you see the Apostle Paul said, when I met you, when I met Eunice and Lois, I knew exactly why Timothy had turned out to be the way he was. Look in 2 Timothy chapter 1. In 2 Timothy chapter 1, he says this in verse 5, 2 Timothy 1 and 5, "For I am mindful of the sincere faith within you, which first dwelt in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, and I am sure is in you as well. And for this reason I remind you to kindle afresh the gift of God, which is in you through the laying on of my hands." How much did he say in there about Timothy's daddy? Why do you think that was? His daddy had nothing to do with the man that he became. His mother and his grandmother is who made him the person that he was. And that's exactly what the Apostle Paul is saying. What I'm going to say to you is this. How do you beat the devil? It happened in the time of Noah. It happened in the time of 1,000 years later, in the time of Moses. It happened in the time of Samuel. And there are many other stories. I could give you half a dozen more that you would be familiar with, where the same devil was sitting there waiting to devour every child that's being born, but people beat the devil. How did they do that? What I would tell you is this. In Revelation chapter 18, I want you to look at this verse with me in just a moment. Chapter 18, verses 4 and 5. And I want to go back a little bit to what I talked about at the beginning of the lesson. Think about a time where everybody lived on a farm and everybody had basically a very close-knit family. And if there was a wolf out there in the family, your mom and daddy and your grandparents knew, well, your uncle, your granddaddy, is a worthless thug and he's not going to be around you. So you had a pristine environment. You had only a certain amount of information coming into your brain, and it was the information that your parents and grandparents wanted you to have. They had a far better ability to control our environment. When I was a child growing up, my mother stayed at home. When Linda and I got married, we made the decision that she was going to stay at home and raise our babies. That's not something that everybody has to go by. It was a choice we made. And the feeling was, being a godly mother and grandmother was important. It's gotten a little better, I think, but I'm going to tell you that in the last 40 years, how much credence has society placed on a woman raising godly children? None. Well, what do you do for a living? What is your occupation? This is what every woman gets asked in the world. Well, what is your education? What is your background? What do you do for a living? So all of a sudden, raising kids became kind of secondary in nature, or maybe tertiary in nature, or maybe almost non-existent. I can subcontract that out. I can have a nanny. I can have whatever. In Revelation chapter 18, verse 4, "I heard another voice from heaven saying, 'Come out of her, my people, that you may not participate in her sins, and that you may not receive her plagues. For her sins have piled up as high as the heavens, and God has remembered her iniquities.'" When you look at the number of passages, in James chapter 3, let's just look at that for a moment as an example. James chapter 3, verse 13 beginning. What all of these passages are dealing with, because of time, I'm not going to look at them, but they have to do with, I have to be able to control my child's environment. When a baby is born, Their brain looks like this board right here. It's completely blank. Nobody's written anything on it. So I have the ability as their parent and grandparent to say, I'm going to start with what's going to get written on this board. And I'm going to get first shot. Yes, I know by the time they're 10 or 12 or 15 years of age, they're going to be seeing all kind of stuff and hearing all kind of stuff. But I got a certain number of years that I'm the only one that gets to write on this board. Or I can control who does. In James chapter 3 and verse 18. Who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior and deeds the gentleness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and lie against the truth. This wisdom is not coming down from above, but is earthly, is natural, is demonic. We're talking about the devil destroying your child. James is using demonic as a description of the world. The world is that devil waiting to devour your child. Verse 16, where there is jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder in every evil thing. Now that is what devours our children. The wisdom of this world. Verse 17, but wisdom from above is first pure and peaceable and gentle and reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy, and the seed whose fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Every single one of these passages deal with, if I cannot control my child's environment, the world will. And that devil waiting there for to devour your child is the world. We may say it's the devil. It's the work of the devil. But if you want your child to act like and look like and think like and be like the world, don't do anything. It's as natural as breathing. All you have to do is just let them be born. And grandparents and great-grandparents, and fortunately we have many cases of multi-generations in this group. If it's okay with you that your children look like the world, for a while it's easy. It's easy. Just don't do anything. Unfortunately, you get over that. It's not so easy. Once they grow up and you deal with all of the challenges and problems that come from letting the world set the agenda for the environment of your child. In Matthew chapter 10, I'm going to tell you something that to me is critical, critical, critical. And if you miss this, as parents and grandparents, you do it to your own destruction. I have to demonstrate to my child that I love God more than I love me. Let me explain that. Every one of us make decisions after decisions after decisions after decision. God gives us a brain. It's the most incredible computer in the world. And this brain allows me to make decision after decision. Now what happens fundamentally is this. If the center of my brain is me, so there are two basic things that I want you to look at. Number one, this is a situation where the center of my life is me. Oh, I go to church. I go to work. I play. I take vacation. I do yard work and so forth. But the whole world, the center of it's me. The center of it is me. What do I want to do? How do I feel? How does it make me feel? How does this make me look? I set all kind of bars that you have to jump over, and if you don't jump over them, I'm not happy with you. Why? Because I'm the middle of the world, of my world. Over here, when God is in the center of my life, it changes everything. Now, what I would say to you is this. When you begin looking at this, if I raise a child, and I teach the child that I am the most important thing in the world, me. Me, what I want, what I like, what I feel. What I'm going to tell you is this. You're going to raise a selfish, self-centered child that puts themselves in the middle of the world and they don't even know what this looks like. I have to be able to convince my children that I love God more than I love me. And I'm putting God's word and God's ways and His thoughts that are far higher than mine above me. I'm going to tell you, this manifests itself from the time children are very little all the way to the time that they grow up. Matthew chapter 10 and verse 32. You see this very clearly. Everyone who confesses me before men, I'll confess him before my Father who's in heaven. Everyone who denies me before men, I'll deny him before my Father who is in heaven. Verse 37 and 38. Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. I have to do that. It has to be ingrained in my children's brain that I love God more than me. And there are going to be a million times in my raising of children and grandchildren where what I think is different than what God thinks. And I get used to it coming out of my mouth. This is the way I see it. This is what I think. This is my way. This is the way I think I ought to do it. Instead of, what does God want me to do? How does God want me to handle this? Do you think the first 10, 15 years of a child's life, 20 years, that these two make a difference? It's phenomenal. How do we teach children godly wisdom versus earthly wisdom? We talked about this a lot, and so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but Proverbs chapter 6 is a tremendous passage where he deals with how you impart God's wisdom to people in their brain, children, instead of your wisdom. And maybe me and my wife, we get together and we tell our kids, this is our wisdom, this is how you ought to fight the devil. Do you think any one of you here that you're smart enough to beat the devil by yourself? Not a chance in the world. Proverbs 13 and 22 and 29 talk about the importance of discipline. I say this over and over again. Your child does not need a buddy. They will get their own buddies. They need a parent. They need someone that can teach them godly wisdom. Proverbs chapter 30. I want to look at that just for a second. In Proverbs chapter 30, we're going to be spending a good bit of time. This is a powerful, powerful chapter. And I love this chapter. But I just want to look at two different parts of this in the next couple of minutes. Proverbs chapter 30 and verse 11. Proverbs 30 and 11. There is a kind of man that curses his father and does not bless his mother. There is a kind who is pure in his own eyes, yet is not washed from his filthiness. There is a kind, oh, how lofty are his eyes, and his eyelids are raised in arrogance. There is a kind of man whose teeth are like swords, and jaws are like knives, to devour the afflicted from the earth, and the needy from amongst men. Verse 17, the eye that mocks a father and scorns a mother. The ravens of the valley will pick its eyes out, is what the text says, and the young eagles will eat them. How does that happen, that a child is raised up to me and has no respect for me? And they don't respect my wife. And because they didn't learn respect at home, they don't respect the first grade teacher. And they don't respect the principal. And they don't respect the high school principal. And they don't respect the law enforcement. And they don't respect the government. But yet, maybe we can take them to church every once in a while and they'll learn how to respect God. When they've never had a minute of learning respect in their entire life. It's just not going to happen. We see a number of times raising our children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Well, a young mother might say, I'm a great nurturer. I'm a great nurturer. Okay, well, that's wonderful. You nurture your child, but if you're nurturing your child the way it seems right to you without a concept of God, good luck with that. That's why he says, you nurture, raise him up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. It's tremendously different. Deuteronomy chapter 6, he talks about when your children lay down at night, you talk to them. When they get up in the morning, you talk to them. When you're walking by the way, it's wonderful to talk baseball and football, and it's wonderful to teach kids how to do all of this. I spent a lot of time with my kids in some of those areas. When it comes to fighting the devil that's waiting there when they're born, how much does that really matter? When you think about Noah and his wife, when you think about Amram and Jochebed, I'm going to tell you that they made the decision, I will fight the devil for my kids. You want to know how did they do it? How did they win? In a situation in Noah's case where there wasn't another family on earth, he didn't have anybody to draw any strength from, but he made the decision that he was going to prove to his kids that he loved them more than the world did. It's not uncommon, very much like in the case, Genesis chapter 3 I have here, it's not that uncommon in the case of Adam and Eve, where the devil decided, I'm going to try to pick Eve off, and I'm going to get her to thinking about God, and why does God want you to do this, and why does God keep telling you, I'm going to tell you, and so he impugned God's motive. What he said was, God just didn't want you to be as smart as he is, that's why he didn't want you to eat of that. So, with that first family, the devil was able to pick one of them off and separate them. Why? He convinced Eve, and I suppose Adam, that he was smarter than God, the devil. And because of that, he won. I want to read to you a little story, and we're closing with this. Read this with me. Mary had a little boy whose soul was white as snow. He never went to Bible class because Mary wouldn't go. He never heard the tales of Christ that thrilled the childish mind. While other children went to class, this child was left behind. As he grew from babe to youth, she saw, to her dismay, a soul that once was snowy white became a dingy gray. Realizing he was lost, she tried to win him back. But now a soul that once was white has turned a dirty black. She started back to church in Bible class too. She begged the preacher, is there anything you can do? And so another soul is lost that once was white as snow. Bible study would have helped, but Mary didn't go. Let me tell you why this is important. In so many cases, I see people that say, well, I can afford to give God 1 hour a week, most weeks, so I'm going to come to worship service. I'm going to come to worship. That's fine. And I've asked people before, do you know what happens in these classes around here for 45 minutes? Every Sunday morning and every Wednesday night? So we have children there that we have built programs to teach them at their level. And we have books and we have people prepared. So if a mother or father has bypassed Bible class, Sunday school, what do you think is going to happen? What exactly do you think will happen to your children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren if they don't get that? They're not getting it at home. And I'm just going to tell you, this is a call that I'm making. You could prove me wrong. But if I'm too busy or too preoccupied to make it here to Bible class, what is the chance I'm reading and studying at home on my own? Unless there's some type of physical impediment. So I want you to think about those things this morning. I appreciate you listening to me. Brother Ashley has a song that he's going to lead us in. I've spent a good portion of my life, even now, with young people who have children who have messed their lives up in some pretty significant ways. And I look at that and say, if I can't help save the 30-year-old and the 20-year-old generation, 25-year-old maybe, then we got another generation coming after them that's going to be way worse. And so I spend a great portion of my life trying to figure out how do we save one soul at a time who may have children or one day will have children. That's the salt and light of the earth. That is the most important thing that we have to do on this earth. So how do you beat the devil? When you see a baby born, I'd like for you to have this picture in your brain of the massive devil whose tail was so powerful when he swept it across the sky, a third of the stars fell. That devil, you think you can whip on your own. Good luck. People have been fighting the devil and doing it successfully. I'm going to tell you the reason why there are churches all over the world, and Linda and I have been a good many places around the world that have strong congregations of people who work and worship together, because people are beating the devil every day. But it's not accidental. If you need to make response in any way, we'll ask you to come together while we sing this song. Have we been to Jesus?